most everybody quite familiar with the prayer, the audacious prayer of Moses in the mountain when he said, "Lord, show me your glory." Heard a lot of sermons preached on that subject, "Show me your glory." But if you read in the book of Exodus, you'll find that before he prayed, "Show me your glory," he first prayed, "Show me your ways. Show me your ways, Lord, that I might walk with you. Show me your ways." And I think perhaps, could it be that if we knew more of his ways, we might know more of his glory? That's something to consider. And that's what I want to talk about today, is understanding something about the ways of God. And we hear a lot in this part of the country about the process. Well, it didn't start in Tuscaloosa. It didn't start there. It started a long, long time ago. And this is, I'm doing encore sermons, and this is one that I preached some years ago here. And I will tell you this, when I discovered this, came to this understanding, it was many, many years ago, other than the theological knowledge and understanding of the saving grace of God and what it means and how to be saved, this for me was this, after that, was the single greatest truth that I've really ever learned. And when I saw this, so much of things in life that, you know, I hadn't quite figured out yet, everything just kind of fell into place, and I could look back and see the course and path of my life in the light of this, and it brought such a point of understanding, and not just to reminisce about what God had done in the past, but as a basis for moving forward to understand that he is still working in that same way. Paul said in Philippians chapter 1 that he who began a good work in you is faithful to complete it. He began, it was initiated by him, he is faithful to complete it. There's no expiration on that until we finally meet him face to face. He is always at work in our lives. And this passage gives us something of an understanding about how God does that. And I've titled this message, "From Vessel to Vessel," and the text is taken from Jeremiah 48 and 11. Let's read it together and pay close attention to this passage. It says, "Moab has been at ease since his youth. He has also been undisturbed like wine off its dregs, and he has not been emptied from vessel to vessel, nor has he gone to exile. Therefore, he retains his flavor, and his aroma has not changed." Now, pay close attention to it. Like undisturbed, like wine on its dregs, has not been emptied from vessel to vessel. He retains his flavor. His aroma has not changed. Let's understand what this means. In its historical context, this verse is a statement of justification for God's judgment against the nation of Moab. The announcement of catastrophe that is quickly approaching the Moabites, humbling her of her pride and chastening her for her sin. That's the direct meaning in its time, real time, to the Moabites in its context. But the prophet Jeremiah here uses a particular metaphor of wine left on its dregs, wine not poured from one vessel to another, and an aroma, a taste, a scent that is unchanged. We're talking about stagnation. This imagery, of course, would have been very familiar and quite vivid to the Moabites because it is taken from the winemaking process for which the Moabites were world famous. As winemakers, the Moabites were connoisseurs, world connoisseurs, renowned for making wines of great value. And I would think that winemaking is probably something that most of us know little about. And I don't know that I need to make a disclaimer, but I believe in teach and practice total abstinence, not an endorsement for wine or encouragement of its use. I'm just using the symbolism that's found in the Bible in the same way that Jeremiah uses it as a description of a process used by the Moabites to make wine. It is a picture of the process used by God to remake people, to shape people, to change us. And the key statement is the phrase, "emptied from vessel to vessel." Now understand how this worked. In its crude, raw state, after it has been pressed and squeezed, the wine then would be pressed from the grapes, poured into a particular vessel where it would remain for a period of time under controlled conditions and the watchful eyes of the winemaker. The purpose of this was so that the wine could settle in that particular vessel. And as it settles and the wine is still, the dregs and the impurities would separate from the wine and settle upon the bottom of the vessel or attach themselves to the side of the vessel. And after a sufficient time lapse determined by the winemaker, he would pour the wine into a new vessel. He would gently pour or dip the wine away from the dregs in the bottom of the old vessel and pour it into a new container. As the wine was poured into the new vessel, the dregs remained behind in the former vessel. Then the process was simply repeated again and again. The new vessel was allowed to remain undisturbed so the separation process could take place without interruption. More of the dregs and impurities would settle in the bottom, and then the winemaker would once again pour the wine away from the dregs into yet another vessel for this process to continue. It was a filtering process whereby the dregs, in some passages they call it the lees, and the word lees is from a Hebrew word that means to thicken or to curdle. And it is the dregs, it is the impurity. It was essential to remove the dregs, otherwise the taste of the wine would take on the foul smell of the dregs and the wine would be spoiled. So this process was repeated again and again. It wasn't the task of a day or two, but with great patience and painstaking deliberateness, the winemaker would repeat this process for weeks and months and perhaps even for years until all of the sediment, all the dregs that could ruin the wine was removed. And to the winemakers of Moab, the pouring was an essential and ongoing part of their everyday lives because they knew that to make a fine wine, the dregs had to be removed. So they were continually pouring the wine from one vessel to another. And each time the wine was poured forth into a new vessel, more and more of the dregs were left behind in the former vessels. Eventually, it would be poured forth as a pure wine, choice, rare, and unique. Now, there were two issues here and two concerns. The first was that the wine had to be allowed to settle in the vessel in which it was poured. Once it's poured there, it would be sealed and left. It couldn't be touched. It couldn't be moved. They couldn't shake it up, or else the separation doesn't take place. If you can picture in your mind a bottle of Italian salad dressing, you know, it has oil and vinegar, then has all those spices. What happens to it when you sit it on the counter and don't touch it for a while? It will separate, does it not? And before you use it, you shake it up to get it all mixed up because you're going to eat it on salad. Well, this is a kind of a similar thing. For the separation to take place, the wine couldn't be jostled. It couldn't be stirred. It had to settle in the vessel. It had to accept the vessel it was poured in and settle there for the separation to occur. Otherwise, the dregs and the wine are mixed together. If you get that picture, do you see it? Everybody say amen. All right. The other concern was this. Not only did it have to be left there to settle, but the wine also had to be poured to prevent stagnation. See, once the separation had taken place, then the wine could not be allowed to remain in that particular vessel, because if that happened, the wine would settle upon the dregs in the bottom, and the smell of the dregs would ruin the wine. If you have ever left an onion uncovered in a refrigerator, what will happen? Over time, everything in the refrigerator will start to smell and taste. If you leave it there long enough, the smell and scent of the onion will permeate the refrigerator, and other food will start to smell and taste like the onion. I think everybody can understand that. Well, that's the same thing that's happening here. It had to be left there alone and not touched for the separation to take place, but once the separation has occurred, it could not stay beyond its time in that vessel. Did you catch that phrase? It couldn't stay beyond its time into that vessel. It had to be poured into another vessel in order, or else the wine would lose its value because it would take on the smell and the scent. Did you hear that? He said that in the verse that we read, he said his wine is not disturbed and his scent is unchanged. It takes on the smell of the dregs. He has not been emptied from vessel to vessel. It retains its flavor. Its aroma has not changed. So there's a fine balance here between these two. If the wine wasn't allowed to settle, or if it was poured too soon, there would be no separation of the dregs from the wine, which was the whole purpose of the vessel in the first place. But if it was allowed to stay in the vessel once the separation had taken place, the wine would be permeated with the taste and smell of the dregs. So it required perfect timing. If you pour it too soon or too late, the wine will be ruined. If you pour it too soon, the separation hasn't occurred and the process is defeated. If you pour it too late, then it will have set it upon the dregs and the wine would be ruined. So it requires the skilled hands and knowledge of the winemaker to know exactly when to pour the wine into the next vessel. And boy, is that not one of the places where we struggle? Is it not with waiting for God's timing? Because we often think we know what's best, and God, you should be doing this, and why are you waiting, and why are you delaying? And we challenge that, and we want to help God out, you know? But the winemaker knows exactly when the wine needs to be poured. So what you see here is this. In Scripture, believers are sometimes referred to as vessels. That's the metaphor that's used. Like, we have this treasure in earthen vessels, Paul would say. But in this particular instance, the believer is not the vessel. In this instance, the believer is the wine. And it's a picture of the process that God uses to purify our lives, to equip us for life and prepare us for ministry. It is the process by which He faithfully, patiently, and gradually removes the dregs from our hearts, the impurities from our soul, from our lives, and makes us into a fine and aromatic wine, a choice blend. And if we are to become all that God intends us to be, the dregs have to be removed. God says, I intend great things for you, but I can't bring you to greatness until we deal with this or that or the other. That's why Joseph spent 13 years in a dungeon. That's why David spent all those years running in the wilderness. Their lives were being poured into a particular vessel because God was taking the dregs out of their lives. You see that? The Chinese have a proverb that goes like this. They say, you cannot carve rotten wood. And that's self-explanatory. You can't make anything of value from that which is fundamentally corrupt and defective. And God is committed to His purpose and to this process. He is faithful to complete the good work He has begun in us. But we can resist that process and defeat that process in these two ways. Number one, we can refuse to settle in the vessel where God has placed us, where God has chosen us. You see, the first thing the wine has to do when it's poured into the vessel, it has to settle there. It has to accept that. And sometimes we don't like the place where God has put us. In fact, God will sometimes, often, will put us in places that we would have never chosen on our own. We would have done everything in the world to avoid that. And it's kind of like in our spirit, God, I don't like this. I don't like this place. I'm not comfortable here. I'm not having this. Yeah, right. I'm not going to put up with this, God. And what happens is our spirits, our hearts, our souls are become agitated and stirred up as we strive against the vessel. We contend against the vessel. We complain against the vessel, the place where God has put us, and we rail against the winemaker who put us there. That's one problem. We simply won't accept and understand that even if it's in a difficult place, that this is the place of God's choosing, because it is there that God is wanting to perfect something in us that He can perfect in no other way, in no other place. I call it life's learning laboratories. Places where He puts us. That's why I'm always telling you that the problem is not what's going on around you. The problem is always, the issue is what's going on inside of me. So when you get in a difficult place, I know the issues are real, but that's not the primary issue. The real question is, what is God doing in my life while I am in this vessel? What is He wanting to do? And there is a place of simply having to accept the vessel that God has chosen so the wine of your life can settle. The second problem is that sometimes once we settle there, we get comfortable where we are, and so we resist the next pour. In the first case, we say, I don't like it here, God. I won't have this. In the second instance, we say, Lord, I really like this place. I just want to stay here. I just want to stay here. Okay? That's what we do. And let me tell you, that's a problem. When God moves, you have to move with Him. If you don't, you find yourself in an extremely difficult place. What happened to the children of Israel out in the desert in Exodus? When the cloud moved, they had to move, didn't they? When it stopped, they had to stop. And sometimes, you know, if it stopped and they pitched their tents and, you know, got the camp all set up, and then the next morning it moves again, they have to pack everything up and move again. And don't you know that when it would come to, you know, some nice, comfortable place, it would probably just stay one night and they'd move on. You know, the cloud would move on, and they say, Lord, we like it here. We want to stay. But what happens if the cloud moves and you stay? Soon that soft place will become intolerable. Because never forget this. You remember the manna? The manna, the provision that He provided for them daily. Guess what? The manna falls under the cloud. Remember when they needed water to drink? He gave them water to drink out of the rock. Guess where the water flows? The water flows under the cloud. The cloud was the covering, their shade from the hot, blistering sun of the Sinai desert. And out from under the cloud, it gets hot and unbearable. And at night, the fire, the cloud was exchanged for a pillar of fire. And that was warmth. That was the warmth in the extreme cold of the desert. You know how it changes from heat to cold from day to night. That's the nature of the desert. So you see, out from under the cloud, life is hard. And no matter when it moves, you have to move with it. And you don't get to tell God when the cloud moves or the direction that it takes. All you have to do is follow the cloud and live under the cloud. That's where you want to be, because that's where the manna falls. That's where the water flows. That's where the fire burns. That's our shelter, our protection, is under the cloud. So what happens is we really like this place, and I'm kind of comfortable here. Lord, I'm kind of tired. I'm tired of all this activity in my life. I'm tired of the pouring. I'm tired of the process. I like where I am just fine. I don't want to be poured again. I'm comfortable right where I am. If either of these occur, our lives will be corrupted by the dregs. In the first instance, the activity that what God is wanting to remove from our lives is never removed, because we simply won't accept the process and the work that He's doing and embrace that and cooperate with what God is doing. So what happens is, we remain unchanged. Isn't that what He said? The flavor stays the same. The scent stays the same. There's no change. There's no transformation. And that's what has happened to a lot of people in church. They've been in church for 30 years, and there's no noticeable, discernible growth whatsoever in their life. They have simply stagnated. And they say, well, I've settled. No, you haven't settled. You're stuck. And they stand and sing, standing on the promises, when in truth they're just sitting on the premises. And in the second instance, we stay too long, and God isn't finished with us yet. There's still other things that He wants to deal with. And what happens to us is we just stay where we are. We resist the process. And at that point, the process is aborted and stopped. And our lives then just simply stagnate. We're checkmated, if you will. By continually striving against the vessels God has chosen, the defiling influences, those things that keep the impurities that keep the gold from shining, if you'll allow me to change the metaphor here, they're never removed. The fire is never intended to destroy the gold. The gold needs not fear the fire ever. The only thing the fire does is burn out the impurities. And the impurities are what devalue the gold, take away from its luster, its shine, its purity, its value. And that's what God is after when He places us in the fire. He's not about destroying gold. He's about destroying the things that keep us from shining brightly as gold. That's why Job said, when he's tried me, I'll come forth as pure gold. And that's the purpose of the trial. Not to make life miserable for us or give us a hard time, but to perfect what is lacking in our faith. Or by refusing to be poured, we settle upon the dregs God wants to remove, and our lives become scented with the foul smell of the lees. And let me tell you, this can happen at three levels. It can happen at three levels. It can happen in the life of an individual. It can happen in the life of a local congregation. It can happen in the life of a denomination or a church movement. Let me talk about those just quickly. The individuals. Life is stagnated. Instead of becoming dynamic, life is static now. The heart has become petrified and spiritual rigor mortis has set in. And you'll hear people say sometimes, well, that's just the way I am. I can't change. No, that's not true. The truth is you don't want to change. Change is about that's what the gospel is all about. That's what you were part of God's highest purpose in your life is to change you and transform you into the image of His Son. I'm sorry, that's just an excuse. That's all that is. And what happens is life will settle in that place and take on the smell of the dregs. I could tell you the story of a man who experienced some very difficult places and was deeply betrayed and hurt and wounded by a lot of people. Those kind of situations will either make you bitter or they will make you better, depending on how you respond to it. He responded in the wrong way, became extremely agitated, stirred up constantly. He settled upon the dregs of bitterness. And let me tell you, whenever you're around him, you can be around him, and in a matter of just a few minutes, the foul smell of his bitterness will come out. It comes out in his language, in his behavior, in his attitude, and he has poisoned his whole household, his children, his grandchildren, with the same bitterness that is in him. That's what I'm talking about. It happens at that level, at an individual level. It can sometimes happen to a local congregation when churches just become comfortable where they are and become content to simply maintain the ecclesiastical machinery, the warm, milquetoast Sunday morning religion that makes little demands and calls for no sacrifice. It just rocks them to sleep. They lose their vision for the harvest. They lose their compassion and harvest for lost people, for the community around them. They lose their heart for the Great Commission, their heart for God and love of people. And they become more of a Sunday morning social club, a religious country club that is resistant to change and resentful of returning prodigals. And it really ceases to be the church that God intended them to be, because church is not something we attend. It is who we are. It's not a place about, not where we go. It's about being. We are the church everywhere we go. And they don't want the challenge of a new ministry. They resist any kind of change. Their famous last words were, "We've never done it that way before." Mm-hmm. And they settle on the lees. They become stagnated on the dregs of lukewarm, powerless religion that the world disdains and the devil mocks. It can sometimes happen to denominations, church movements. I tell you again, there have not been 2,000 years of church history. There have been 50 years of church history repeated 40 times. And it goes in cycles. And if you stand on the street corner long enough, the parade will come right back around again. Mm-hmm. If a denomination, and ours is not immune, if we fail to discern the fresh moving of God, if we stop listening to the voice of the Spirit, if we become more interested in protecting our wineskins and our sacred cows and guarding our institutions, where our procedures, we become prisoners to our procedures, and protecting the system becomes paramount, and maintaining the polity and polity and structures, and the rule book now takes precedent over the fresh moving of God. And if leaders become obsessed with protecting their offices and their authority and their perks and holding on to their niche on the denominational pyramid, the original purpose for our existence is shoved into the background and buried beneath flowcharts and organizational plans. Somebody said church history and movements can be defined in five stages. They all begin with the letter M. It begins when God finds a man. And in this case, it means mankind. Sometimes the best man is a woman. Like Deborah in the Old Testament. Godly women. Hannah. Okay, but he finds a man. But you see, woman doesn't start with an M, and that messes everything up. Okay? So he starts with a man, and when he finds a man, God brings a miracle. And the miracle becomes a movement, and the movement then becomes a monument. And the monument becomes a mausoleum, followed by God looking for another man. And that cycle has repeated itself countless times throughout church history. If we fail to discern and refuse to move with the Spirit, we refuse the next vessel, and we simply become, with protecting our tradition and our heritage, we can become settled upon the foul dregs of institutionalism. And to my knowledge, there is no denomination in history that has ever recovered from institutionalism in its last stages. Not one in history. So what is God's purpose in all of this? In this parable, the vessel is distinct from the wine, and the value here is on the wine. The winemaker chooses the vessels. The wine has no say and cannot choose the vessels. The wine has no say what vessel or how long to stay there or when the pouring begins. All the prerogative belongs to the winemaker. So what's the key issue here? The key issue is trust. Do you really trust the winemaker? Does he know what he's doing? What are his intentions? Especially when you're put in a hard place, is there an abiding confidence that God knows what he's doing and that he will always, I mean always, do what is right and best for his children, even when they don't think so? Do you have that confidence? So that's a key issue here. He knows, and here, he knows exactly what kind of vessel is necessary to remove the particular dregs that may be in your life, that are in mine, that are unique to us, and refine our lives to the unique and specific purpose he has in mind for each of us. So the vessels he chooses are different for each of us because the dregs in my life are not exactly like yours. Now, we all have issues, and we all have baggage, and we all have areas of brokenness, but it's not the same. He knows the defiling influences in my life. He knows just what kind of dregs there are in my attitude. He knows what he needs to perfect within me, so the vessels he chooses for me will be unique to my need and my purpose for me, and it may be entirely different for you. In fact, you can count on it. It will be. He looks into my heart. He sees what would spoil the wine. Wow. You talk about, can you just for a moment rest right there and grasp something of God's intimate knowledge of you and the intimacy and the concern and the care that he has for you? There are 6 billion people on this planet, but he cares about you as if you were the only person here. That God looks into my heart, he sees and knows what would spoil the wine, that would defeat his purpose, that would abort the process that he intends for me. And when he does that, then he selects the right vessel. And I think it's a strange one, because it wouldn't be the one that I choose. But he selects the right vessel that allows him to confront and change those things that will corrupt my life and spoil his purpose. So it's a very unique process. So what is his purpose here? Number one, to conform us to the image of Christ. Now, if you've been here any length of time and listened at all, you should know this. And a lot of people live their whole life in church and don't understand this simple, fundamental, basic principle of the gospel and God's purpose. Some people think of salvation simply in terms of fire insurance. It's about being saved from hell and going to heaven. Is that a good thing? No, that's a wonderful thing. That's a great thing. We want to be saved from hell and go to heaven. Amen? But that's not God's ultimate purpose. His highest intention is that we be conformed to the image of His Son, Romans 8:29, for whom He did foreknow, He did predestine us to be conformed to the image of His Son. That means that God in advance, it wasn't an afterthought. Whoops, I forgot something. No, from the very beginning, God had determined in advance that it would be His purpose for those that He would save, that He would work in their lives. That's what we're talking about today, to conform us to the image of His Son. And if you're paying attention, I just quoted Romans 8:29. That comes immediately after, of course, Romans 8:28, that says, "In all things God works together for the good of those who love Him and are called according to His purpose." We're talking about His purpose. "For whom He did foreknow, He did predestine us to be conformed to the image of His Son." And Romans 8:28 has to be understood in the context of verse 29. It is in the context of God working in us to conform us to the image of Christ that He is working in all things for our good. And it simply means that in every circumstance, every situation of life, God is able to work for the good. What good? The purpose of transforming us into the image of Christ. And you're looking at a picture of how He does that. It's not so much about doing, it's about being and becoming. Becoming. The second thing is that He wants to fulfill His unique purpose for each of us. You see, you've heard me talk about this before, finding your sweet spot. There's a general purpose that God has for all of us, that we be saved and come to the knowledge of the truth and live for Him. But how that works out specifically is different. God's call on my life, very different than His call on your life and what He intends you to do. So I talked to you about finding the sweet spot. Remember, in the game of golf, in the middle of that club, there was a sweet spot. If you find it, it's wonderful because the ball will go long and straight. But if you hit the ball on the toe and you're a right-handed golfer, you're going to slice the ball because it will put slice spin on the ball. If you hit it on the bottom of the club, you're just going to roll it. It'll just have top spin and roll. If you hit it too far under, they call hitting that shot fat, it'll just pop it straight up. Finding that sweet spot, it's right in the dead center. You can play golf all your life and never hit the sweet spot. And a lot of golfers do. It takes lessons usually and a lot of practice to be able to hit it consistently. You can play golf all your life without finding the sweet spot. But you won't enjoy it, and it won't be much fun, and you probably will not win. You know how many people there are who live their entire life without finding their sweet spot? The place where they are specifically called to be. How do I find that, Pastor? How do I find that? Now, that's another sermon. But one of the keys is, where are your gifts? Because, see, if you're not using the gifts that God has given you, then you're not operating in where God has called you. Because the gifts are matched, they're commensurate with, they correspond with His calling. I could never ever be a children's pastor. That's not my gift. I understand that. I don't try to go there. And if you don't understand your place of calling, what God has called you for, His specific purpose, then you can miss it. In the game of baseball, there is a strike zone. A strike zone. And usually, you know, each umpire kind of defines that. But generally speaking, it's the width of the plate and then, you know, to the knees and the armpits and some variation there. And if a batter doesn't know the strike zone, he will swing at anything. And probably strike out. If you don't know the strike zone, you'll swing at anything. When I was pastoring in Fresno, the senior chaplain's job at the police department came open. Captain Garner asked me, said, "Would you be interested in that position?" I didn't have to pray about it. I didn't have to think about it. I said, "No, sir. I'm happy to serve as a volunteer. But in my mind, this is outside the strike zone. Chaplaincy and working ministry, that's a part of my life. But I am called to pastoral ministry, and that's the sweet spot. And here comes this pitch, and hey, it's a pretty nice pitch, nice salary, all that stuff, benefits, everything. It was a good gig. But it was outside the strike zone. I didn't swing. I didn't have to pray about it. Because I knew, no, this is outside the calling. Mark Twain said, "The two greatest days of your life are the day that you're born and the day you discover why." Because some people will spend their whole life without any sense of a unique calling and unique purpose, because when you hear that, they think, well, called to be a missionary, or called to be a Reinhard Bonnke, or called to be a Billy Graham, and they think of it in terms of it has to be big and sensational and in the spotlight, and nothing could be further from the truth. The greatness of the call has nothing to do with the size of the task. The greatness of the call has to do everything with the one who has called you. And if all he has asked you to do is give a cup of cold water in his name, then give it for his glory. And he said, they will not lose their reward. God's purpose for you is different from his purpose for me. And that's true of all of us. Have you found that purpose? Have you really sought for that purpose? In finding the will of God, listen, the will of God is not lost. You don't have to kick in the door to find His will. It will open to your touch. And very often, finding the perfect will of God for your life is not about searching for purpose. It's really about searching for God and finding God. Let me just take a little extra time to tell you this. Because remember on the Damascus Road, when Paul is going down to Damascus and the light shines around him, he asks two questions. He asks, Lord, who are you? Then he asked, Lord, what will you have me to do? Do you hear the questions? Lord, who are you? Lord, what will you have me to do? There are a lot of people who are asking the second question. Lord, what do you want me to do? Who haven't really asked the first question and gotten an answer yet. Do you hear me? The first question is, Lord, who are you? And let me tell you, when you focus there, when you find God, you will find your purpose. That's what happened to Moses at the burning bush, remember? God has a purpose for Moses, right? He doesn't know what it is yet. That's to send him back to Egypt as the deliverer, the emancipator. But what happened before God revealed his purpose for Moses? God revealed his name to Moses. Lord, what did Moses ask? What is your name? Who are you? He said, I am that I am. And there in the light of that flame and bush that never burned up, God revealed his presence. And then his purpose became clear. You don't find your purpose by searching for purpose. You find your purpose by finding God. That's how you find it. And if you're too lazy to pray or too busy to pray, or this isn't important to you and you're just willing to kind of rock along through life, living on mediocrity and missing what God has intended for you, then you'll never find it. You'll never find it. You just run through the rat race and come to the end of your life and wonder, what was it all about? He wants to fulfill a purpose in you and in me that is unique. You ask, why all the pouring? Sometimes we get tired of it. And you just would like to settle. Why can there never be any settling? Why so many vessels? Listen, the reason is because there is a vision in the heart of God for a beautiful and wonderful fragrance and flavor, unique to you and you alone. And that's why he is relentless in his love and will not allow you to settle and not allow you to stagnate on the dregs. That's why all the pouring from one vessel to another. And if you don't understand this, the process can be very frustrating and aggravating. And not only do we come to hate the vessel that we're in, you can find yourself railing against the winemaker who put you there. But if you understand the process, there is an acceptance that allows our spirit to settle in the vessel, even if it's disturbing, even if it's unpleasant. Lord, I know that in this vessel you're removing impurities from my life. You're making me more like Jesus. You're fashioning my life according to the unique purpose you have for me. And Lord, listen, your activity upon me is the guarantee of the value you place in me. You understand that? It is a great expression. It is one of the most obvious expressions of God's love for you and the value that He places in you, that He would work so intensely in your life in this way. And reveals your ultimate intention towards me. Can I tell you, there is a direct correlation between great ministry and great trial. And the greater and more intense God's purpose is for you, the greater and more intense will be the testing, because this is the only arena of preparation that God has. You can ride by the vineyards of California up in Napa Valley, and we've done it many times, and you look across those vineyards where they're growing those grapes, and I look at that, and I remember that out of that very same field, now listen to this, some grapes are harvested in a very short time and made into cheap table wine that will sell for $7.99 a bottle. But out of the very same field, other grapes are worked for with years to become value and expensive wines. And to me, it is mind-boggling to think. The reason I paused, I heard an old guy say, that's mind-boggling. And I almost said, mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling to me to think that somebody would pay $50,000 for a bottle of wine. But the super rich do that. What is the difference between a cheap table wine and a choice vintage? The only real difference is how the grapes respond to the natural processes of water and sun and all that's going on to grow them. When we understand this, you got to decide, you just want to be cheap table wine? Or do you really want God to do something significant in your life that will last for eternity and have eternal value? If you come to understand this, instead of pouting and whining and questioning, oh God, why is this happening, and all that kind of thing, you actually come to anticipate the next round and welcome the vessels, no matter how difficult they may be. And when I came to understand this, I looked back over my life, and all of a sudden, the difficult days in Iowa made sense. Some of the most painful days of our life. Oh, but the dregs that were removed there. When we poured forth out of that vessel, the dregs that were left behind. And suddenly, Sacramento made sense. And things that happened 23 years in Fresno, this circumstance, this situation, I could look back and almost see the vessels in line. And the places where God had poured and poured and poured and poured. Until finally one day He poured me here. I don't know where the next vessel is. I don't know when the pouring will be. I don't set the time for that. I just follow the cloud. When the cloud lifts and moves, I'll move with it. It's just that simple. And can't argue with that and can't complain and can't fuss with that. I don't know when that will be. We'll leave that with God. You know what? He's pretty smart. Have you figured that out yet? He is really smart. He is too wise to be mistaken. He is too good to be unkind. So when you don't understand, when you can't find His plan, when you can't trace His hand, trust His heart. He will always do what is right and best for His children. Now let me finish up quickly and talk with you about a few vessels. Now, there are more than this, but I don't have time. But I do want to talk about this. I want to talk about three. The first one is what I call the vessel of misunderstanding. Now, if you've never been here, this won't mean much to you, and you think, well, that's no big deal. And you just wait till your life gets poured here, and you'll sing a different song. If you've ever been in this place, it is one of the most uncomfortable, awkward places you can ever be in your life. When people are on the outside of the vessel you've been poured in, and they're looking and thinking, something wrong with the wine, what's going on? But you know inside, a different perspective. If you've never been in this vessel, you won't understand this. But you might want to listen, because I got an idea that you may be poured there. It's hard to settle here, because we want every decision and every action to be understood and approved by others. And there's this inherent need to vindicate ourselves anytime we're being misunderstood, or especially if we're being attacked by someone else. This is when your best intentions have been misunderstood and misinterpreted, and what was intended for good was twisted into something that wasn't good. And can I pause and give you a word of advice here? If you're the one on the outside of the vessel, you want to go slow making judgments and evaluation of where other people are. Because here's something I know. Listen to me. The farther away you are from any circumstance, the more likelihood it is, the easier it is to have an opinion about it, and the more likelihood is that you're wrong. Because You're not close enough to know what's really going on. And what you think you know so well may in fact not be the case at all. I can give you several examples, but here's one. This is an absolute true story of a pastor in our denomination. It was down in Florida. He's at home on a Monday. It's his day off. And he was actually doing some work in the house, doing some painting. The phone rings. It's the overseer. Brother, could you come down to the state office? Well, if it's important. Well, it is important. There are two men here accusing you of adultery. Well, I would say that's important. I'll be there as soon as I can change clothes. He only lived about 40 miles away. It didn't take him long. When he got there, he walked in. And there were two men there, a pastor on his district and the clerk of that church sitting there. He couldn't even get in the door. He walked in the door, and they immediately jumped on him. Don't deny it. Don't lie about it. We know you did it. We know for a fact we saw you. And he's like, we know for a fact that you spent the night last night at your clerk's house. Your clerk is a woman. We know for a fact that her husband was at home, and we know for a fact that you stayed there all night because we were watching outside the house and saw you leave this morning. The overseer looked at him and said, brother, is that true? Did you spend the night at your clerk's house? He said, yes, sir. She's a woman. Your clerk's a woman? Of course she's a woman. What else would she be? I don't know. Our culture seems to be confused about that these days, doesn't it? The other clerk's a woman. Was her husband gone? Yes. You stayed there all night? Yes, sir. Left this morning? Yes, sir. What do you have to say for yourself? He said, I can only tell you that I really love this woman. She's the only sister I have. Now, isn't it amazing how that one word left out of the conversation, changed the whole complexion of that story? Isn't it amazing? So you might want to be careful that you may, before you start passing judgment and think you know what's going on somewhere else, you may not have heard the word sister yet. And did those men lie? No. Everything they said was true. He did stay there all night. The clerk was a woman. Her husband was at home. And he stayed all night. Everything he said was true. But it was what they didn't know that changed the complexion of it. You better be very, very careful, or you could be calling somebody's sister an adulteress. Amen? You know what really tickles me about that story? Is while he was asleep in a warm bed, they were sitting outside in a car all night watching the house. Now let me tell you something. If you're ever in the position of this man, now he was vindicated pretty quickly. You ever been in a position where your best intentions, your actions were completely and totally misunderstood? And in some cases, you're not in a position to defend yourself? Because if you defend yourself, exonerate yourself, it may hurt somebody else. It may violate a confidence, and you're not in a position, and you just simply have to take it. That's not a soft place to be in. Or you know in yourself that they don't understand everything that's going on. And the harder you try to fix it, the worse it gets. And you can't explain it, and you can't track down everybody who's heard the rumor that is a lie and straighten it out. And it's an uncomfortable place to be because people are looking and saying, what's wrong with the wine? And there's nothing wrong with the wine. It is a vessel of misunderstanding. And you just simply have to live with the fact that there are some people who have misunderstood, have judged you wrongly, and you can never fix that. It is a tough place to be. But let me tell you, when you are poured from this vessel, you will leave behind the need for self-vindication. Perfect example of that is Jesus, who before his accusers was like a sheep with his mouth closed. No defense. And allowed God to do the vindicating. I can tell you that when we went through the difficult time in Iowa, I was just a young guy. I didn't know. It was the Holy Spirit. The Lord spoke to me and said, if you won't fight, I will fight for you. I'll fight for you. But if you lift one finger in your defense, you're on your own. But if you'll trust me, I'll take care of you and I'll fight for you. And the vindication will come, and it'll come from me. And that's something I learned. I grew in 3 months, I grew 10 years spiritually in that particular vessel, this difficult vessel of misunderstanding. Let me move quickly. The second one is the vessel of strange guidance. You want a picture of that? Let's look at old Abraham. Talk about strange guidance. That's when the leading of God makes no sense. It makes no sense. Abraham, leave your home. Your homeland, okay? Where are we going? I'll show you. Can you imagine as he packs up and he leaves and somebody, hey, Abraham, where are you going? I don't know. You don't know. Well, what direction are you taking? I don't know. You don't know. What are you doing? I'm just following the leading of God. The writer in Hebrews said he looked for a city that hath foundations. Looking for a city. Looking for a place. God had promised to make him a great nation, a great land. But the truth is he saw more deserts than downtowns. More sand than sidewalks. He journeyed through the wilderness at night. He pitched his tent. He built his altars. He lit his fire. And the next day, he does the same thing. And it seems to have no rhyme or reason whatsoever. And then, when you think it can't get any stranger or inexplicable, God says to him, sacrifice your son. It makes no sense. Because, number one, God... In the law, God would forbid child sacrifice. That was an abhorrent sin. Why would God ask that? That makes no sense, does it? Theologically. But at a logical point, it makes no sense because if I'm going to be a great nation, it's going to come through my son, Isaac, who will beget Jacob, who will beget the 12 tribes of Israel from which the nation of Israel... If Isaac is killed, there is no great nation. By the way, there is no Messiah. There is no salvation, and we're all lost. So how does this make sense at all? It doesn't. And I'm just glad that during all of this, I wasn't Abraham's pastor. He would have been at my office every week, wanting counseling. And I don't know that I could have helped him. Does it make any sense? Well, in hindsight, it does. Well, I mean, we know how the story ends. But Abraham didn't understand all of that. The fact of the matter is there are times when the leading and the direction of God is inexplicable. And he may not explain it. In fact, he may never explain it. The things that I've been through and places I've gone in my life, I look back, I can't figure it out. I've quit trying. I don't need to know why. You know why? I don't need to know why because I know who. I know Him. And that's all that's necessary. Listen to me. As believers, we rejoice in the works of God. But those who truly know Him rejoice in the ways of God. The last one. Is the vessel of a long, dark night. A long, dark trial. David said, weeping may endure for a night, but joy comes in the morning. That's wonderful. But what if the night endures for longer than a night? And weeping does, and joy doesn't come in the next morning. What if the night is longer? There's a classic work written by St. John of the Cross. It's a Christian classic. You know what a classic is? It's a book that people talk about but have never read. I read this. It's originally written in Spanish, translated into English. But more than that, I lived it. He called it the dark night of the soul. It isn't a test. It isn't a trial. It isn't a valley. It isn't a wilderness. It's all of that rolled into one, multiplied by 50. And the chief characteristic of the dark night, don't miss this, is the sense that God has abandoned you. Is the absence, the apparent, that's the key word, apparent absence of God. You want to read about it in Scripture? It's in Job 23. That's the best scriptural description of the dark night I've ever read. Where he said, oh, if I could find him. If I knew where his office was, I'm paraphrasing. I'd like to make an appointment with him. If I could just call his secretary and get an appointment and go and sit down across from him face to face and just have it out. Have you ever wished for something like that? Lord, it's like, you know, I'm praying, but I wish I could just sit down and you sit in this chair and let's have a face-to-face conversation. Be careful about asking for that, because a few chapters later, that prayer is granted and God shows up in person. And Job is like, whoa. Stand up and brace yourself like a man. Where were you, Job, when I created the earth? And he asks him question after question. He's not bullying his servant. He's revealing his presence to him. And when he sees, God, you know, he said, I'd heard of you, but now I've seen you. You see the difference there? I've heard of you. Oh, we've heard about it. We heard about it in Sunday school in flannel board pictures. And now on DVDs, and we've grown up, we've heard, we've read about it, we've heard sermons, we've sung song about it, we've heard about it. But when you see him, and let me tell you, that's often the purpose of the long dark trial, is that it is there that you see him and find him. And let me tell you, in the long dark trial, the dark night of the soul, and let no one ever assume that the dark night is a mere 12 hours. Mine lasted 18 months. I thought I would lose my mind. And had it been for Benita and two good friends and the help of the Holy Spirit, I would have. In the dark night. Let me tell you, in the dark night of the soul is where your superficial understandings of God are stripped away. And all the little bullet points and all the little principles and all the little principles that you've learned and think and quote, he defies them all and reveals himself as he did to Elijah in the mountain. Not in the earthquake, the wind and the fire. Elijah was familiar with that. Mount Sinai had been smitten with earthquake, wind, and fire in Exodus 19 when God came down at the establishment of the covenant. He came down, the mountain burned with fire. The place shook. The ground shook like an earthquake, and the ruach, the presence of God, the wind, the breath of God was present there, and the people were overwhelmed. And he goes back trying to get in touch with an experience of his past. Yesterday's blessing. And this time he's not in the earthquake, the wind, or the fire. All the things that were familiar to him. That's not where he found God. Finally, he hears it in the still, small voice. And Hebrew scholars will tell you that there was actually no sound at all. What kind of heart do I have to hear God when He is silent? And God is saying, we're not repeating something of your past. This is not redundancy. We're not going to do repetitious things. We're not going back to do something again. But Elijah, I am bringing you, listen, to a place that is unprecedented. I'm revealing myself to you in a way that you have not known before. Yes, I was in the earthquake. I was in the wind. I was in the fire. But I'm moving on. I'm showing you something deeper so that you can be so close and so intimate with me that you can hear me and sense me even when I am silent. And that is the essence of the dark night. Is the silence of God, the emptiness of that black space. When it appears that God has moved to the remote corner of the universe, is answering no prayers and returning no calls, and it seems that He has abandoned you. And that's exactly what Job felt. That's what he experienced. He said, I'm searching for Him and I can't find Him. Read it in Job 23. He said, I look to the left and He's not there. And to the right, He's still not there. Before me, behind me, I can't find Him. I can't find Him. It is this elusive presence. But there's this wonderful little nugget there that you've read for years, but you haven't read it in context. He said, I looked to the left and couldn't find Him. To the right, I can't find Him. Before me, behind me, I can't find Him. But the Lord knows the way I take. What does He mean? I don't know where He is, but He knows where I am. I can't find His way, but He knows the way that I take. And when I'm tried, I will come forth as pure gold. You know what He said? I've esteemed the words of your mouth more than my necessary food. The vastness of the universe was shrunk down to one thing, and that was to hear the voice of God. In the dark night, I came to that place. Lord, I love my friends and I love my overseer. They're good, godly people. They're praying for me, but they cannot help me. They cannot give me what I need. There's no book at the bookstore. There's no DVD. There's no revival meeting. It has to be me and you. And there comes this sense of desperation that you have to hear the voice of God. And you wait and He's silent and you're still waiting and you're waiting. Here's the key to hearing the voice of God. If He isn't speaking, you can't hear Him. Don't be a ventriloquist and throw His voice. You simply have to wait. And 15 months into that ordeal, He finally spoke to me just one word. And I've shared that with you before. It was a word and direction from God. In the dark place, all the superficial misunderstandings of God, the bumper sticker theology that you see posted on Facebook all the time, I just look at it and, nah, just leave it alone. Just don't go there. The superficial understanding of God, our systems, our categories, the little box that we've put Him in is absolutely demolished. You come to a place of understanding and knowing God that you could not have found, you would not have found any other way in any other place. It's when God leaves you alone. And you're like Joshua stuck on the side of the mountain in the dark while Moses is on the top. The people are celebrating. He's stuck on the side of the mountain. It's when God hides, like with Jehoshaphat. He hid from him for a season so that he might show him what was in his heart. He hid from him. He hid his face from him for a season that he might see what was in his heart. Do you know, listen to me, and I'm through. Wines of great value spend much time in the dark. They spend years in dark casks. And in the dark, a miracle takes place in the wine. They're hidden away today in dark wine cellars. Their years written in chalk upon the cask. And only the winemaker knows where they are. When you're poured from this vessel, you will leave behind the dregs of mistrust and impatience and come to a place, an understanding of God that you've not known before. Never be surprised at the vessel He chooses. Never be surprised when He empties you from the one you are into yet another. It's His process that He is committed to. And before He ever began to work on you, in His mind He already saw what He wanted you to be, what He intended you to be. And He's lined up the vessels in order to make that happen. Where are you? Do you have an understanding? Do you know where the strike zone is in your life? Do you know where that is? It doesn't matter how old you are. Never too old to find it. And if you're young, you've got a head start. Find it now. Pursue it now. Pursue what you know. And you find that not by seeking your purpose, but by seeking His presence. And as He makes Himself known to you and you walk with Him, He will show you. He will show you the way. And He will never, ever lead you astray. Too comfortable where you are? Just kind of settled down now? Spiritual rigor mortis? No growth, no progress. You're in the same place you are today where you were last year, the year before. I'm trying to help you today. I'm not trying to scold you. I'm trying to help you. God is wanting to pour you into a new vessel. So I'm going to ask you, please. That's enough. I preached enough.